text in another context a couple of months ago. Let me read it again. Love from the center of who you are, the divine center. Don't settle for faking it. Find the love source within. Find the love source within. And live the good life, the virtuous life, the noble life. This is how you find the divine center. Run for dear life from vice and hold for dear life to virtue. And love deeply. Devote yourself to being a good friend. When it's time to play second fiddle, do it with your whole heart. Honor one another. Care for one another. We're talking in these weeks about the ancient virtue of charity. We're talking about it in the context of it being the crown jewel of the virtue curriculum. But even that word, charity, is difficult to contain the whole concept. And what we've seen in the early weeks of this lesson is that it is a multifaceted virtue. It is a broad, broad concept that is hard to contain in words. It's hard to contain the concept in the word charity. It's even harder to contain it in the word that is often translated in 1 Corinthians 13, love. So what we've seen it is this natural outflowing reality of the practices of the soul, which we've put up on the board. When we embark on this spiritual journey, when we embark on this spiritual life, something happens to our souls. When we care for ourselves, taking on the four kinds of practices, when we practice the communal and the contemplative and the learning and the serving practices, what we've seen is that we change. And we change the way that a seed changes when it is exposed to soil and sun and water. And I'm getting cold. Are you getting cold? We change when we take on these practices the same way that a seed changes. It is just a natural outflow of growth. So you'll hear today, as you've been hearing several times, the seed does all the work. And what we find is that when we give ourselves in service to the divine life that is in us, the divine breath that animated us from the beginning, what our story tells us was breathed into us from the beginning that makes us us. When we give ourselves to the service of that, and that's what those four practices, four categories of practices are. When we do that, growth happens and fruit is born. And the fruit that is born is that word that we're trying to capture, that virtue that we're trying to capture. Love, charity, the Greek word for it is agape. And so, it is a rich, multifaceted virtue that embodies something about love and something about strength. It embodies something about self-settledness. Because when we have this fruit born in us, we tend to awaken to our place in the universe and have a deep, abiding sense that we belong here. A deep abiding sense that we are connected to the divine and that the divine is connected to us, that there is a oneness reality that is bigger than a two-ness reality, things we've talked about in the past. We realize that as we live in this oneness dimension, it provides a foundation that gives us a new vision. And we begin to see not just the part, but the whole. We gain a bigger vision than just what is good for me. I can't just react to my own feelings of hurt, and I can't just be frightened by my own need for security. I can't just have my own fear of rejection. I can't just protect my own autonomy. What happens when this vision captures us is that we see those things. Certainly you do fear for your own survival, and you do care for your own rejection. Those things are part of it, but it just when you stand back and see something bigger, that can't be the defining characteristic of life. So, the crown jewel of virtues tends to elevate our vision, and we begin to see the whole, not just the part. We see our connection to the divine spirit that is deep within us, and we see our connection to the divine life that permeates all that is. and we see the other, and we see how connected we are to the other, and we see how connected the other is to ourselves, and we see that it will not do for me not to be afraid if they are afraid. And it will not do for me just to work for my own security if the other is feeling insecure. And we see that it will not do for me to comfort my own fears if the fears of the other are not comforted as well. And we see that it will not do for my own children to be well and thriving if the Afghani child is not well and thriving, or the Rwandan child is not well and thriving, or the other child that is part of the NRCC community is not thriving. And so what happens is this bigger picture awakens inside of us, and it changes us. That's the fruit that is born when the divine seed inside of us begins to grow. And we begin to see the interconnectedness of the whole system. You and me and them. Democrats and Republicans and Haitians and people you know personally and people you don't know personally. They are all one, not two. This whole thing is a connected system of God life and God being. And you and I, we're right there in the thick of it. And so we see this. And it changes us. We see this, and it changes everything. And quite naturally, we begin to care. We begin to care for the whole. Quite naturally, we begin to have compassion for the whole. Quite naturally, we become peacemakers and servant leaders. And this whole virtue we're trying to capture with the word charity begins to be a natural outflow of this expanded vision. This bigger picture begins to change our behaviors because we have seen. And those who have been part of this Judeo-Christian that we follow and who have gone before us have, generation after generation, having elevated their vision and having seen the bigger picture, have taken their part in the mission that comes with the having seen. And that mission is to be healers of the world, repairers of the earth. And for our generation, as we have seen, it is to us to take up the mission that is now affecting our society. And in Western society, we've seen the problem that we face is the fragmenting, the tearing of the fabric of community and connectedness. That over the last 100 years, there have been social forces in place that have steadily begun to unravel the place of belonging and the sense of connectedness and increased our sense of alienation. And so when this fruit is born inside of us, we can no longer abide simply getting offended at the irritating PTA lady. Instead, we have to have a bigger picture and figure out how it is that we can help her in her efforts to connect students and parents and teachers so that the system will thrive. We can no longer simply avoid the brokenhearted man in the cubicle across the hall because we don't know what to say or how to say. We have to awaken to how it is that we will figure out what to say so that we can go forward and become agents of encouragement and comfort. And it goes on. And it goes on, and it goes on in this multifaceted expression of divine life that crops up inside of you and crops up inside of me when the fruit of servicing the spiritual life is born within us. And we call that charity or love or this crown jewel of the virtues. So, since we took a week off last week in order to talk about the practicalities of how we as a community would be part of this journey, I thought it would be worth a little bit longer review than normal, so that's a review of where we've been. So now let's go and begin and look at the text that we began with. Love from the center of who you are, the text says. Find that divine life that is in you and you will find love. Now, you may have to fake it till you make it. That's true. If you listened to the Journey to Oneness part, the lesson that we did at the beginning of the year, you realize the first part of the Journey to Oneness is servicing the virtue curriculum as a discipline, as a practice, making yourself do these things. And that might Well, that will be how you have to start the process. You will probably have to discipline yourself to be kind and compassionate to others. You will probably have to hear secondhand what people do when the divine life erupts in them, and then you will have to fake those things, even though you would prefer to be selfish. You may have to work hard to be nice to others. You may have to work hard to challenge your selfishness. You might have to work at giving money to orphans or sending funds to the Red Cross in the Philippines, or volunteering with Wynn, or going toward the outcast at work and inviting her to lunch instead of staying away from her. You might have to discipline yourself to do those things, and that kind of discipline is important. It's how we begin to feed the seed that is within us. But the text says, don't settle for that. That can't be all there is. There is something more. When you serve the virtue curriculum, when you tend to the soil of your soul, you will find that as you walk through these three stages on the journey to oneness, as you create the environment for your soul to thrive and prosper, you will find a divine center. It is what makes you, you. And when that happens, and when you see that interior center, when you begin to draw from it, it changes you. And so the text says, don't settle for anything less. Let the seed do the work. Let the fruit come to harvest. And when it does, you will love deeply. You will devote yourself selflessly. You will honor others. You will care for others. This will happen to you. Like generations who have gone before you, you will see the need of your generation, and you will respond to the solution to that need that we face as a culture. As I said, we live in 21st century America, and that being the case, this is one of the times when we have an epidemic of a deep wound to the human soul called alienation. It is that sense of disconnectedness that we carry, that sense of not belonging. And when the divine fruit that is born in your soul begins to bear fruit, you will see that need and you will take up the grand mission in your small part of the world for healing what is broken. You will take up the mantle. Other generations before have called it being about the Father's business. You will be about the work of creating community that folds the outsider in. You will rise above the me emphasis that is bred into us as consumers in a consumerist culture, and you will care for the other, and you will restitch the broken fragments of community. That's what followers of Jesus do. They see the need of their time, and they step in to meet that need. That's what Jesus meant when he spoke of the kingdom of God. We've said it so many times, the deepest longing of the human soul is to know and be known, to love and to be loved, to be folded in, not kept out. And not intentionally, but because of a convergence of economic and social and political and belief system forces, we have found ourselves over the last 100 years facing this epidemic of not having met that deepest longing of the human heart. More and more, we feel that we do not know and we are not known, that we do not know how to love intimately and deeply and be loved intimately and deeply. More and more, we sense that we are disconnected. More and more, that we sense that we are alone. More and more, we feel a sense of being unable to trust, more and more guarded, unable to let down our self-protective mechanisms, more and more unable to let someone else in, more and more feeling the need to fend others off and make sure that we are safe. And that's true for our society. That's true in the meta trends that go on around you. But I've spoken with you, and I know the people in this room, and I know from conversations that that's also true here with many of us. We are children of our generation, and we are affected by the ills of our time. We ourselves feel a sense of disconnectedness. We sense that we need other voices in our lives, other hands about our lives. And even if we have managed to delude ourselves, which many of us have, because that kind of primal longing to know and be known is not an easy thing to admit when it doesn't happen. So even if we put up a mechanism that persuades us that we're fine, we still suffer the consequences of the lack. We zig when we should have zagged because we don't have the wisdom of community around us. We tend to have instincts that cause us to disrupt those very patterns that would create the relationships we want because we don't have a context in which those relationships are modeled and shaped and hammered out. And so consequently, even though we persuade ourselves we're doing fine, there is still the consequence of that lack of being part of a communal spiritual entity. So what's happened is, as a society, we've developed a whole bevy of instincts that seem designed to keep us in that state, to keep us alienated one from another, a whole set of instincts that keep us going it alone. And even though we might be wired for, we might have the abilities embedded in us to begin to facilitate and to coordinate those pockets of places where people could reconnect and community could be restitched, nevertheless, when we consider that possibility, even if we're wired for it, we feel like we're just too exhausted, or we've been burned, or we've been hurt, or we still feel self-protective. Because we've been part of this society, and these social and political and economic forces have been going on for a long, long time, and we've been hurt. And anybody with a half a brain is in no hurry to go out and get hurt again. And so we may have what is needed for the very mission that is set before us. We may feel the growing up and the prompting because of the divine spirit within us. The whole fruit may be being born, and we might be poised and ready to go and fulfill the mission that is set before us as follower of Jesus. But we shy away from rebuilding the environment that we ourselves need and that others need because our instincts hold us back, once burned, twice shy. So the cycle perpetuates. And so Doug stands up here from time to time and says stuff like this. And people think, yeah, that's right. And people think, yeah, we should do something about that. And so off they go to do that. And so here you are. You're the good people. You're the ones who say, yeah, that's a problem. We're going to go out and we're going to work on it. And so off we go. But when we go, no matter how good our intentions are, we nevertheless bring our instincts with us when we do. Okay, I'm going to go give this thing another try. I do want to be part of this grand mission of rebuilding the fragmented community of our time. So I'm going to go tutor a child, or I'm going to be part of the community care team at church, or I'm going to go toward that coworker, or I'm going to do some such thing. But again, wherever we go, we bring our instincts with us. And one of the primary instincts that you as a Westerner carry is called the cult of the individual. The cult of the individual. And it started as a great thing. Most deeply embedded things do. It started as an honoring and a celebration of the uniqueness and preciousness that we carry in ourselves, each one of us. It started 500 years ago. It started 1,600 years ago when we moved into the West, but then it really took off 500 years ago when we began to acknowledge together in this Renaissance awakening of the human reality that each one of the human beings carries a divine beauty inside. And it started as a beautiful thing and as a wonderful thing. But over time, like all good things, it has tended to devolve. Now, life doesn't honor the preciousness of the individual. Life is centered on the individual, centered around what I want, centered around servicing my desires, centered around chasing my aspirations. The individual defines what matters in life. I don't any longer think about the health and the well-being of the school. I think about how my grades are when I'm in school. I don't think about the health and well-being of the company. I think about my own personal advancement within the company. I don't think any longer about the well-being of the neighborhood. I make sure that my yard looks good and I'm protected and my privacy is intact. I don't think about the well-being of the community at church. I just make sure that I choose one that's got a good minister. By the way, you chose well. And so what happens is I begin to think about how things are going for the individual rather than thinking about the context in which the individual thrives. And if you've heard the story of the commons, you know that that doesn't have longevity. Life is good as long as it's working for me and for mine. And that's the cult of individualism instinct that we all bring to bear because we grew up in this society. But it doesn't have longevity because it won't go for very long for everyone to be thinking about their experience of the organization before the organization itself can't care for anyone within the organization. And so this devolution is a result of the cult of individualism instincts that we all carry within ourselves, and it has betrayed us. It has betrayed women. It has betrayed men. This cult of individualism has betrayed the middle class. It has betrayed the poor. It's in the process of betraying the rich. Each one of the races that make up our pluralistic society, each one individually gets betrayed. And that's easy to see. And if you watch the news and if you pay attention to the society that we live in, you can see what I just said. But that's not even the devolution I want to talk about today. That's not the most damaging and destructive thing when it comes to restitching and rebuilding community. Because the flip side of the cult of individualism is an exacting and ruthless curse. The flip side of the cult of individualism is about as harsh a taskmaster as ever comes. And it imposes upon us a demanding form of enslavement. It's a curse that we carry around inside of ourselves that, put simply, is this. As an individual, it is up to me. As an individual, it is up to me. I have to be the maker of my life. I have to be the maker of my destiny. It is to me, the individual, that all the responsibility for making life happen falls. And when you hear me say those words, you might even be thinking, yeah, what's wrong with that? That is kind of how we think. And we don't even recognize from within this pool we live in that that's a tainted perspective. It is a curse that we carry. So even if I were to marshal my efforts to then re-engage community, even if I were to feel that sense of having fed my interior soul's well-being, awakening the divine life that is in, and even if it came out and I saw the need that is the alienation and fragmented community of not belonging need, and I began to engage with that, I would nevertheless go about the engagement still carrying that harsh taskmaster born of the cult of individualism. It is up to me. I have to make this thing happen. And so we would walk into our endeavor carrying all that pressure. And what could unfold quite naturally, and at other times in history has unfolded quite naturally, often does not. Because carrying this truckload of pressure upon ourselves, we feel it is up to us to solve our own alienation problems. Yes, I've got an alienation problem. I do feel a sense of disconnected. It would be better if I had more connections in my life. So here I go. I've got to make this thing happen. Or I might put a bunch of pressure on you, which is I'm going to walk into this endeavor one more time. And I've tried it before. And I've been around people. And I'm a little wary. So I'm watching you. Are you going to make community happen for me? Are you going to make this thing happen for me? And I'm a little bit careful and I'm a little bit guarded. But I got to tell you, the pressure is on you. Or the pressure is on me to make it happen for you. Because now when you walk in with that sense that that pressure is on me, I take it. And I say, yes, you're right. That pressure is on me because you're an individual and I'm an individual. And being a good individual, I'm going to take this responsibility on myself as an individual. And I'm going to take care of this. And the whole system doesn't work. And it doesn't matter if you feed your soul. And it doesn't matter if you take on the four practices. And it doesn't matter if the seed begins to bear fruit and you do what every generation before us has done. You step into the fray that is the social problem. You bring the instincts of the problem to bear, and those very instincts undercut the efforts. And it doesn't happen. So we walk into the fray carrying that pressure upon ourselves. We put it on one another, and it doesn't happen. And so we walk away from our efforts exhausted and embittered and disillusioned. I've noticed something here at NRCC, and that is those of you that have been around for a long time, when we pull out another one of those stupid start engaging in community again things, you don't do it. It's the new people who do it. They haven't been burned enough yet, so they're still ready to give it a try. The rest of you people think, been there, done that, there's nothing there for me. So carrying those expectations on ourselves as we do, that I have to fix my own alienation problem, or I have to fix somebody else's, or somebody else has to fix mine, it just doesn't happen. And we say things like, you know, those people, they're just pitiful. They're just as whacked and broken as I am. There's nothing there for me. Or, those people, they're pitiful, and they need what I've got. And I am giving it to them, and they're not appreciating it. It's just as Jesus said, pearls before swine. It is just that. And either case, we conclude there's nothing there for me. That's what pressure does. That's what the cult of the individual does. That's what we grew up in. Those are the instincts that we bear, which makes it very difficult for us to rise to the challenge that faces our generation. Makes it very difficult for us to be conduits of charity, the thing that grows in our souls, because even when the growth instinct arises, it gets countermanded by these instincts that we carry by being growing up in this culture. The new bud of growth that begins to develop in our souls gets nipped off. And this happens enough times for enough years, and pretty soon hopelessness sets in. Yeah, yeah, Doug, we've heard it all before. I signed up for one of your stupid community restitching groups once before. There's nothing there for me. And so, perhaps we don't take seriously enough the toxicity of this cult of individual that has done so much wonderfulness and so much benefit for us as a society. That's not uncommon. When I was in marriage counseling about year 7, it was a really tough year. I was deeply committed to marriage, but I could not see how this thing was going to possibly work out. At some point, the counselor said enough things about me that I realized I might be part of the problem. I was, up until then, I was pretty persuaded it was Denise. And I said, and I remember showing up for counseling one day saying, okay, this is going to stump her. So I went and I said, so what I'm hearing you say is that this thing that you're calling me out in is causing the troubles in our marriage. And I said, so here is this thing, and it has given me success doing this, and it has given me success doing this, and it has given me success doing this. It has given me success, and I just went on and on and on listing all the wonderful things that had happened because of this very trait she was saying. And she said, wow, that is impressive, because I had lived an impressive life, and this was an impressive list. And then she said, I thought I'd stumped her, and then she said, looking at Denise, well, how is that working over here? And I could just look at this woman. I knew that I had married this flower, this wonderful, vibrant person, and she was now, if we were to use the image of a flower, she was wilted. She was just slumped over. She was worn out. And I didn't know how it was my doing, but I knew somehow it was my doing. And that's when I began to realize that the thing that gives us so much treasure in one regard undercuts and destroys us in another regard. And that is exactly what the cult of individualism has done. You can make a case for individualism in so many places. It does so much good. It has created Western society as Western society is. We should celebrate what this strong individualistic focus has done, except in these areas where it is destroying us. It is killing us. And so for us to rise and take up the mandate given us as followers of Jesus, we're going to have to go against the blindness of our own society. But that has been the gift of the Judeo-Christian tradition. The Judeo-Christian tradition brings this incredible balance to bear on this very topic. It has not been our way to overvalue either the communal or the individual, but to bring balance to both. Ours has been a tradition that venerates and honors and affirms the preciousness of the divine light that is in you and you and you and me. in each one of us individually, carrying the divine light. We use our strongest words to talk about it. We use words like sacred or sanctity or holiness to talk about how precious the divine life is in each individual. But at the same time we say that, we also insist that the individual is not the whole story. The individual finds his or her context as part of the connected whole. It is the whole that gives meaning to the preciousness of the part. You can't understand the individual unless you understand the web in which the individual thrives. It is that interconnected web that gives context and purpose to the part. So we have a long history of making place for both. We have a well-rehearsed set of standards and practices. We talk about ethics and we say, this is what it means to be an ethical person. This is how you live a moral life. And we do that for the purpose of protecting the web, of keeping the web functioning and intact, healthy and whole. We have a long list of sexual norms, and we say, this is what you do to protect the deepest points of connection we have in our lives. And we say, this set of practices will work to connect the web and the intricacies of the web in the family and in the love and the system we have for one another. We create rules of thumb and best practices standards, all of which are designed to make the whole work well together. We focus on and we insist on spiritual friendship. We teach the art of confession, the art of self-awareness, but also self-disclosure, working and functioning within the web. And so in so doing, we both honor the individual and we honor the community. And we find the balance point from which health emerges. So when you see me up here waving the flag for keeper of the food, or when you see us waving the flag for getting involved in Enneagram groups, or when George stands up here and talks about these kinds of ways people can connect with one another, we're saying this is an essential part of an ancient tradition that is being dishonored in our culture, and our instincts are betraying us. Now, we haven't always felt the pressure to make this happen because we haven't always overvalued the individual. We haven't always carried the weight that I've got to make this thing happen. At our best times, what we've done is simply create the environment and invite one another into it. And then we just live in that environment. We give one another the gift of the soil and the sun and the water. And then the seed does all the work. The divine light within you, when it emerges, does all the work. The virtue of charity just grows up inside of you, does all the work. There has always been a cadre of people in our tradition who have risen to the challenge of whatever ill faced their time in society. One generation, when that fruit began to be born, worked for universal education because they recognized that everyone needs access to the growth and possibilities inside of them. Another generation worked against the tyranny of alcoholism that was so affecting the poor, particularly among the immigrant classes. Another worked to abolish slavery. Another generation started the hospital movement, each one of them bearing the fruit of the virtue of serving the divine spirit within. And for our generation, that mandate is to restitch together the torn fabric of community. When we have been at our best throughout all of history, the seed has done all the work. We did not surrender to the tyranny of the community, and we did not surrender to the tyranny of the individual. We just created the environment. We encouraged one another, and we made space for each other to make the communal practices part of life. We encouraged one another, and we made space with one another to make the soul-quieting practices part of our lives, and the learning practices, and the serving practices. And if you're paying attention to the announcements at NRCC, you are hearing invitation after invitation after invitation to enter into this well-worn tradition that has these deep abiding effects of feeding the soul. But your instincts are going to betray you. You're going to think to yourself, I'm too busy. You're going to think to yourself, I've got to protect myself. You're going to think to yourself, I would be embarrassed. You're going to think a whole lot of things that would keep you from entering into this tradition that has so served the well-being of the soul. Because when we've done this right, we just created that environment, and then we stood back and we watched. And what happened when we service the well-being of the soul is that we, our people, our Judeo-Christian tradition, has again and again, generation after generation, changed the world. We have healed what is broken. We have reconciled what is alienated. We have set right what is wrong. We've made good what has gone bad, and all we did was let the seed do the work. We didn't go out there and marshal our efforts and white-knuckle this thing into happening. We just let the seed do the work. So, I hear my wife's questions in the back of my head all the time when I'm preparing lessons, and she's always saying, Doug, make it practical. So here we go. We're going to make it practical. Are you ready? So I get it, Doug. I should give my soul the soil and the sun and the moisture to make it grow. And yes, you do that by this circle of practices that you put up. And yeah, let's do that. So how do I do that? Exactly how do I do that? Let's finish with that. My goodness, how did we get going late? Let's finish quickly and we will be out. Well, we're not going to be out on time, but we'll be close to out on time. So I think here's how we do it practically. A couple weeks ago, Loretta spoke up in one of the lessons afterwards. And she said, you know, Doug, as you've been speaking, I realized that there is this XYZ character issue in my life, and I need to work on it. I can't remember what the character issue was. Good, 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 I said. And then I said something in reply. And then Denise spoke up and said something in reply to my reply, and what Denise said was better. So I said, here's what I said. And I think this is true. I said, okay, you may find that the right way to go after XYZ character issue in your life might not be the direct approach, but it might be the indirect approach. That might be better. And I put up the circle of four practices. And I said, if you go up and do these four practices, you make these part of your life, what you might find is that by watering the soul and by taking care of that, this divine life might grow up inside of you. And one day you will find a place where XYZ used to dominate your life, and this character flaw would just bump in, and without you having to work on it, this time you'll realize, wow, I walked into the same circumstances and I didn't react the same way that I had reacted, and you will realize at that moment, I said, the seed does all the work. And I believe that. All we do is water the soil, take care of the issue. And that is true, I think, and that is helpful, I think, as far as it goes. But again, what Denise said was better, because what she said was this, yeah, but. She said, what Loretta's doing, Doug, is she is seeing this XYZ issue in her life. And when she sees XYZ issue in her life, man, that's the journey made large right there. Because as soon as we see, we start paying attention, and now XYZ is on our radar. And if you pay attention, then you will find that God or the Spirit of God or the indwelling reality of the divine or the universe is constantly giving you a smorgasbord of what you need to address XYZ in your life. And that Denise said, is better because it drills down further into the practicalities of how we move forward on this. The idea of restitching community in our society, even at your job, even in your home, even in your neighborhood, is just way, way, way too big. But pay attention, because the spiritual journey can be distilled down to two steps. It's a two-step dance. What's step one? Please, someone know. It is desire. But now that you know step one, you should know step two. What is step two? Pay attention. Desire and pay attention. This is the two-step spiritual dance. Desire and pay attention. Desire divine life. Desire growth. Desire XYZ character attribute. Desire the virtue. Desire the fruit of the Spirit. Desire those things. And then pay attention. I lived in China for a long time, come down to Hong Kong on a regular basis, and there was this great dim sum restaurant in Hong Kong. If you don't know what dim sum is, it's like tapas, if you know what tapas is. Lots of little tiny things. And so in this dim sum restaurant, they had a river that ran through the middle of the restaurant. And this river was, you know, it was built up. It was about this tall. It was about that wide. And it just had water that flowed through it. And it went from table to table all the way through the whole restaurant, just kind of circled it way through. And then it made a circle. And what they would do is they'd put a bunch of dishes in this thing and they would float. And so this thing would float right by you and it would come by and you'd sit by the table. And if a pink dish came by, that was like a dollar. If a red dish came by, it was like 50 cents. And so you would just just pull out the dishes you want. Each one had a little morsel on it about that big, and it would come out. And at the end, they would just come up and count up your plates, figure out what color they were, and that's what your bill was. That was a great place to go, and that was a nice restaurant. So I remember enjoying that restaurant because, you know, it's unusual. How many places do you go where they float the food by you, and that's fun. But also, I remember thinking, this is a metaphor of the spiritual life right here. Because what happens is, if you're paying attention and desire is what produces that attention, then God, the universe, the Spirit is constantly floating by exactly what you need, and all you need to be able to do is reach out and take that. The key is in the paying attention. And lo and behold, what those four practices are, all those invitations that you're getting to come get engaged in some dimension of those four kinds of practice are just ways that we have for the last few thousands of years figured out will help us pay attention. The communal practices help you pay attention. The contemplative practices help you pay attention. The service and the learning practices help you pay attention. And if you will desire and pay attention, everything you need. Now that XYZ is on Loretta's radar, if she's paying attention, it's almost done. It's almost a done deal at that point, because God, the Spirit, the universe will bring the breakthrough that is required for us to move in to that dimension of life. So, desire and pay attention. Feed your soul to help you pay attention. Take up the attentiveness that's embedded in the four practices. Pay attention. Spirit of God, may we awaken to the divine life and breath that is within us. May we be conduits of, agents of the life that is born of the Spirit and the mandates that is set before us for our time and our generation. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, if you would, please prepare your tithes and offerings. And as you're doing that, Robin, come on up.